University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. A bit later in the program, we'll hear the opening ceremonies of the Douglas Fairbanks Jr. exhibit at the Mugar Library, featuring comments from the Director of Special Collections, the Chancellor of the University, and the widow of one of the past century's outstanding entertainer diplomats. But first, we're following last week's program on racial junctures, the examination of the history of racial stratification in the United States, with a conversation on racial identity itself, what it means, where it comes from, whether it is changing, and if so, in what direction. Joining me from Boston University's African American Studies program is Director Ronald Richardson and Allison Blakely. Both are professors of history in the College of Arts and Sciences. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What is racial identity?
Well, I think, this is Professor Blakely speaking, I think that the way we understand it now, the way we use it now, is a very modern phenomenon. There was a time, for example, if you go back to the 16th, 17th century, the term race was used very loosely. There's reference in the literature to the Muscovites as a race, you see, or other Europeans as a race. We don't describe European countries or empires in that way in more recent times. And I think it's very recent that our conception of race in the way that we use it now to try to define ethnic groups and colored peoples, that's something I think all of that is very modern.
So how did they handle it in antiquity, Professor Richardson? Was there such a thing as the white race, the yellow race, the black race?
No, the white race basically is a creation of modern America in Europe. And much of it had to do with the slavery of African American people in the Americas and the way in which European immigrants assimilated into America, becoming white, in the words of Noel Ignatieff. In classical antiquity, you don't find color prejudice. You don't find racial thinking as we have it today. In other words, a person's intellectual ability and cultural accomplishments were not correlated with morphological features such as hair, skin color. The Greeks and the Romans certainly recognized physical differences among people. When they wrote and spoke about people we would call black, they had judgments that fell all over the spectrum. Sometimes they praised them, sometimes they condemned them, but not in terms of their color.
I think it's also important to sort of round out the general response to your initial question, that the concept of class, up until very recently, everywhere in the world, was much more important than any kind of concept about race or color. And even in our own time, I think the North American perception of the definition of racist is somewhat unique to North America. For example, if you go to the Caribbean or you go to Brazil or South America, or if you go to Europe and you refer to yourself as black and you happen to be very light complexioned, you'll find that everyone's puzzled what you're talking about. And this black and white kind of a division, I think, is something peculiar, that one drop concept.
Yes.
Something very peculiar to the way slavery and racism evolved in the United States of America.
Which is why Gunnar Myrdal called it the American dilemma.
Well, yeah, he's referring to basically there the segregation of African American people of African descent in the Americas. But when we began, we didn't really recognize the differences in color prejudice and how that played out throughout the Americas until we began to do comparative history. And then late 40s, early 50s, a man named Frank Tenenbaum wrote a book called Slave and Citizen. And before him, right after him, Gilberto Freddi wrote a book on slavery in Brazil. And we learned that people there did not have this kind of one-drop rule. So the puzzle is, I guess the question still is, why in America do you have such a rigid division between black and white and nothing in between?
In preparation for the program, I did some reading which seemed to indicate that the first colonists came from cultures in Britain that did not have, there was not slavery in Britain, and sort of invented it here. Is that what happened?
Well, the slavery has existed all over the world at all times.
True.
And I guess in Western Europe it had died out, oh, maybe in the 14th or 15th century, and the serfdom still existed in Eastern Europe. There were black slaves in Europe, and Professor Blakely can say more about this, in the 15th, 16th century, and some of them got to England. So the British knew about slavery. Some have argued that one of the reasons North American slavery was so harsh was that the British appeared to have had very little experience with very, very dark people until they began their involvement in the slave trade. Now, that's one thesis. I'm not sure I buy that.
Mm-hmm. It's important to note in reference to one of your comments that although the Europeans didn't have African slavery in Europe, the slaves in Europe were Europeans. The main source of slaves in Europe up into the Middle Ages was Eastern Europe. They associated Russia with a region from which you would get cheap labor. And that's why the word for slave in so many of the Western languages is based on Slav. And this association of slavery with black Africans came about in part because that became a more desirable site to gain slaves after the Islamic empires came to dominate the Mediterranean, and it became more expensive for the Europeans to have to deal in that part of the world, and they started looking for alternative sources of cheap labor. And then, of course, once the so-called New World was discovered and these various types of agriculture became such profitable industries, that's what fueled the African slave trade, and that's what led to the close association of slavery and people of black African descent. It was kind of a pragmatic decision rather than something based on notions about inherent inferiority of Africans, at least initially. It's only later that some of the theories that we're familiar with came to be evolved to justify perpetuation of that kind of an institution.
That's Professor Allison Blakely of the College of Arts and Sciences and the African American Studies Department here at Boston University. I'm Ted O'Brien. You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas, and we're engaging in a conversation about racial identity. Also joining us is the director of the African American Studies here at Boston University, Associate Professor of History in the College of Arts and Sciences, Ron Richardson. This is helping to explain something that I understood just from reading Shakespeare, that Othello the Moor, a flawed character, was also a man of great gifts, a successful soldier, governor, etc. And apparently in Shakespeare's time, while he may have reflected some of the stereotypical feelings toward Jews, for example, in The Merchant of Venice, in Othello there did not seem to be a particular color. Is that an accurate interpretation?
Well, there's a mixed interpretation of Othello. Certainly, you know, one wonders why Shakespeare chose Othello. And perhaps one of the reasons is that he's exotic. That also tells us that the English people at this time were aware of people from different cultures. Now, they would have been aware of people from different cultures because this is the age of expansion. So they were aware of Native Americans. But Europeans had been in contact with Islam for centuries. And the Islamic armies that conquered the Iberian Peninsula were Berber and Negro. So they would have seen people before. But I think you're basically correct about that. He's not selected as a character to vilify because he has passions out of control because he's black. I think it represents the ambivalence at this stage. You don't really see a full-blown racial thinking. You don't see full-blown anti-black thinking.
So where did we get our conception of race just in the last 300 or 400 years?
I think one of the subjects I've done some research on is the evolution of black identity, which is something slightly different than race. Well, it's more specific. I haven't broadened my research to include the entire concept of race, but I was fascinated by how that evolved. And it's a complex subject. I haven't fully satisfied myself yet that I know when it started. For example, some of the root of it goes back into the ancient world through religious sources. For example, the Hamitic, the curse of Ham, that kind of thinking.
The hewers of wood, the drawers of water from the
This has a very long history.
All right.
And the notion that the world is divided into races that are descendant from some of the original major peoples has been very prevalent. The point at which the really negative kinds of associations emerge is I guess the real question. Not when did the concept of race, when did it become stigma? And like in my own research, when did blackness become stigma?
And the question then is, how does culture come into play here? I mean, once we're in the 21st century and can say that this is a handful of insignificant genes, skin coloration, eye shape, so on, what more can be said? Doesn't the matter go to what we're taught, that is, to culture?
Well, I'd just like to return to the idea of the origin of race for a second. And I think in order to have that, you have to have the conception of human beings as basically biological entities. Well, and once you have that conception, then you're going to want to classify those biological entities. You didn't have that conception in classical antiquity and throughout the Middle Ages. Conception of what a human being was in classical antiquity and throughout the Middle Ages was that this was a moral and ethical entity. And the physical characteristics were there, but they weren't the defining characteristics.
Okay.
By the late 18th century, you're getting this notion is emerging, that human beings are biological entities and connected with the animal kingdom. And a landmark document in that, of course, is in the mid-19th century, the publication of The Origin of Species, which links human beings in this chain of being from the most simple organism to the most complex, that is the human being, and then on up through God. It's the great chain of being kind of turned put in physical terms. And once you have that, then you have the ground for saying Jews are different, blacks are different, because we can find or at least conjure up some physiological differences, and that those surface differences must reflect some sort of internal differences. Then you have the concept of race.
So it's very recent.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think what really reinforces the evolution of these concepts is the way in which the modern world has evolved, where one part of the world, Europe, came to dominate much of the rest of the world. The way in which modernization and industrialization tended to define the way the world is going, and the kinds of ideas that emerge to accompany that development are ideas that tend to justify and reinforce the kind of domination that you have there. When you have a visible, very obvious domination of one part of the world or one kind, seemingly kind of people over others, then there is a tendency in time for someone to say that that's the way things should be and that is the way that things should continue. And so the kind of ideas that are associated with so-called scientific racism are those kinds of ideas. That there was an alternative kind of explanation that could have explained the way the world is going, but it came to be profitable. For one thing, for example, for a while slavery was profitable, so you wanted to find a way to sort of satisfy your conscience if you had one about the brutal treatment of other beings. So you even raise questions about whether they really are human beings. That's one way to justify the continuation of that kind of practice.
Well, one of the, and just picking off with what Professor Blakely's saying, if you want to. If one wants to date these sorts of things, I mean, one of the best dates to use is 1776, when, I believe it's 1776, where Edward Long publishes a three-volume History of Jamaica. He's a planter, he's a member of the British Parliament, and he describes Africans as another, basically another species of human beings. And this is blatant justification for slavery and the slave trade. So the role of slavery, I think we haven't talked about enough, and the slave trade, the turning human beings into a commodity and tools for producing wealth. Now, that's not necessarily a problem. It's a problem because it runs directly into other aspects of European and American culture, the notion of individual liberty, all men are created equal. And so the kind of the epitome of this emerging racial ambivalence is Thomas Jefferson, who says, "I tremble for my nation when I recognize that God is just." He wrote in a letter to a friend that, you know, I'm agonizing over this. I know slavery is wrong. I know it breeds hostility and contempt. And yet he says, every time I think of emancipating my slaves, I hesitate because I need to pay my bills. And he recognizes that this is wrong. That's the dilemma. I mean, and if a man like Jefferson can't resolve that dilemma, what hope was there for others?
But your point is well taken, that in order to enslave in the modern era with these concepts of freedom, you have to dehumanize.
Well, slavery and freedom goes hand in hand, as Orlando Patterson has offered. You've got to have an explanation for why this is an exception to the rule.
Have all cultures made these kinds of racial distinctions we've been talking about? We touched on this before. We have a vague understanding, for example, that the Chinese regard themselves as the center of the universe. But was this or is this the same thing as the European-American sense of racial superiority or centralness?
No.
I think it's mainly cultural as opposed to racial in the way they think of these things. But I'm out of my element when I start talking about Asia.
Well, no, I think not. You find the type of modern Western, put it this way, you don't find the type of racial thinking that we have in the West in China and Japan, for example, until the late 19th century. And that's when the Chinese are trying to throw off European imperialism. The Japanese are nationalizing, industrializing. They begin to adopt the ideas of Herbert Spencer, Darwin, and Benjamin Kidd, and some of the social Darwinists. They then begin to adopt this modern notion of race. Before that, there's ethnocentrism. The Chinese rank barbarians in terms of their nearness to or distance from the imperial center. And they talk of raw and cooked barbarians, those that are more assimilated into Chinese culture, those who are further away. Chinese did go to Africa in the 15th century, and they describe African lands. They don't describe them, however, in racial terms. They use the term black, but that's not necessarily a pejorative term. So I think we can say that it is Western imperialism and colonialism carrying these notions around the world that come up with a modern notion of race. Now, that, of course, doesn't exculpate nations like the Japanese, who perpetuated racist atrocities in Asia during World War II. They took the ball and ran with it during that time period.
How did the conquistadores see the Aztecs? Did they see them as different from Africans, for example, of the time?
I think they definitely saw them as different, but once again, they had a motivation very quickly to dehumanize these people. At the same time, I think it's always a mistake to overgeneralize. There are some eyewitness accounts of people who arrived there at the earliest stages who admired these people. But fairly quickly, those forces, those kinds of market forces or others...
The gold.
...tended to totally overshadow morality and all other kinds of considerations. And you even had the church actually supporting the direction that things took.
They were read as heathens and therefore to be converted, but also
to it's a little bit more complex. And you have to look at the case of the Caribbean and the case of the mainland. What Professor Blakely says is, it makes me smile, because when Columbus comes in, if you read his journals, he begins by saying, "These are the loveliest people in the world." I'm paraphrasing. "These are wonderful people. They're harmless." And then very quickly, he says, "Wait a minute. A small group of men could enslave like hundreds of these people. They have no weapons. They're defenseless lambs." And he, in fact, does begin to enslave them. When they get to the mainland, this is a kind of a different situation, because here they find a city, Tenochtitlan, which was greater in terms of its masonry, physical structure, and size than any European city, anything the conquistadores had seen. And it's not the Cortes doesn't come into Mexico with a group of 100 people and conquer the Aztec Empire alone. The Aztecs were a minority group that had been in power maybe 90 years before 1516 and 19 when the conquest occurs. So at the end, when the final conquest occurs, Cortes has maybe a million Indians who hate the Aztecs. And with a group of maybe 1,000 Spaniards. And they rule in the beginning in kind of cooperation with the Indians. So there's a period during which this racial thinking evolves. Now, the Spaniards did make a distinction between Indians and natives. De las Casas, the missionary who pleaded eloquently to save the Indians, had an idea for preserving them, and that is to bring in African slaves to do the work. And the Spaniards quickly began bringing in African slaves.
Ronald Richardson, professor of history at Boston University and director of African American Studies. He's joined today by Professor Allison Blakely, who's also a professor of history and with the Department of African American Studies. We're talking about racial identity. So, in the end, all these grand notions come down to individual human beings, to I, each individual's sense of identity, who he or she is. So how do race and culture shape identity today?
It's getting very interesting. I just returned from a month in Europe, and I was amazed. I was based in Paris, but a couple of side trips off. I was amazed at the impact that what we often refer to as globalization has had now. And I was particularly interested in visiting the representatives of the African diaspora in these areas. I went to a conference in Switzerland, for example, on racism in Switzerland. Never anticipated in my life that there would be such an event in
Switzerland. You mean in that perfect world?
Exactly. And that's what the Swiss have been saying for decades. And but in Paris, I went to an all-day conference on black hair, politics, economics, and black hairstyles, and over 100 Africans and French people were there talking about the same kinds of issues that, male-female relations within the black community, kinky hair over straightened hair, all the same kinds of issues in Paris. You know, I never expected that. And the whole question of how one defines himself is really interesting in Europe, because we call people there black who do not think of themselves in that way at all, and some would even be insulted. Mm-hmm. And our sense of sort of instant black community, if you see a group of them, you expect them to associate, not true.
Why would they be insulted?
Well, in part, that's a very good question. In part, because this whole notion about blackness being such a negative thing is so powerful in Western culture in general, that in a way that's more likely to be an insult than a compliment or just a descriptive kind of expression.
It's unfortunate that still continues. I mean, if you look at the history of racial thought in America, the greatest worry perhaps was miscegenation. Between 1868 and the early 20th century, over 5,000 African Americans were lynched. In the overwhelming majority of those cases, the claim was that a rape had occurred. Mm. And why is there this hatred of miscegenation? Because that's where racial categories break down. As segregation collapses, as the world shrinks, as we are increasingly, I hate to use it again, the term globalized, mm-hmm. then there's going to be more and more of a tendency, I think, for the correlation between race and personal identity, and even culture and personal identity, to begin to break down. You're going to find more and more hybrid identities. And I think that's the direction we're moving in.
Although in terms of African Americans and whites, the intermarriage is extremely low compared with Asian Americans.
And that's the heritage of race. There are some who argue, like Harvard professor Randall Kennedy, who's outspoken and attempts to be provocative, that the way to solve the race problem is to promote interracial marriage. And he says that we should look at people who engage in these marriages as national heroes. I don't know if that solves the race problem or creates another group that's looked upon as a privileged group, but there's no question in my mind that we have a long way to go. The African American group remains the most despised group, even though there has been tremendous progress. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Times reports today, the Boston Globe ran a report today saying 70% of Americans think that Americans are rude and nasty, et cetera. Sure. But however, attitudes towards blacks and gays and women have improved. But this is a very serious issue. Still, you don't see very much interracial dating, interracial marriage on television shows. And where you do, it generally tends to be a white male and African American woman. And I think that we're still seeing here some of this old notion of protecting the white woman, the sacredness of the white woman.
Our guests are Ronald Richardson and Allison Blakely. We're talking about racial identity in America. Before we move on from the historical, I'm from a part of the country where I think of myself as an American, perhaps next as a Midwesterner where I grew up, with an Irish-German background, and then maybe incidentally as being white. Is this simply a luxury that I have as a result of being quote-unquote white in a white-dominated country?
I think it may
be. Good question.
I was born in a part of Alabama that goes back to the slavery period, and my parents on both sides were sharecroppers. Their parents and grandparents going back had been slaves, and I never had the choice, really, of thinking of myself first as an American. You, my generation, I've just, in the early 60s, didn't have that choice. Maybe this generation coming along now may come closer to having the kind of choice that you have. I mean, maybe it's symbolized by the new census provision where one can select their identity. I'm descended on one side also, as Professor Richardson pointed out, from American Indians, from both my mother and my father's side. That part of Alabama had quite a bit of mixture of the Africans and the Indians, and so I'm aware of that kind of mixture, but I never really had the option growing up of identifying myself as Indian either, until even living in the North.
The world was very quick to define you.
Even in the North, until I was, I think, 8 years old, I couldn't sit downstairs in the movies.
I see.
Yeah, I mean, there has been a lot of talk over the last decade or so about the cultural or social constructivity of race.
Yes.
But that doesn't make race go away, because as Professor Blakely just said, he had to sit downstairs. And I remember I'm a bit younger, but I remember as a kid, advertisements in the paper, in the real estate section, for whites only, or white only need apply. There's still racism in the United States. So one of the reasons that African Americans maintain, not the only reason, but one of the reasons African Americans maintain a sense of identity is this kind of defensive stance towards an aggressive outside world. This is, Du Bois' notion that I see myself through a veil. I'm always being defined by the outside world. So, yeah, I think this is one of the advantages that Americans of European descent have. They can decide what to be or what not to be, what to do, what not to do. My father was advanced in years when he had me. He had two sets of children, and he comes from the Caribbean. He came from a land where it was nearly all black. Was an acolyte in the Catholic Church. The minister, the priest, was black. Had never experienced racial discrimination. He came here in the 1920s. Went to Chicago. Got an electrician's license. Was getting a degree to be electrical engineer. The only job he could find was as an elevator operator. He went to church the first Sunday and sat in the first couple of pews. The usher came a little while later and asked him to move back. Well, this process of moving back went on for the entire service, and at the end he was standing on the steps. He didn't know what was going on. because in the Caribbean, families own pews, and he thought maybe that. And he asked his uncle, and his uncle explained. And my father never went back to church. In fact, he's from that elevator operator job, he ended up maintenance of a 40-story building in New York. Yeah, that wall is there, and he tried all his life to see himself as a human being. And I think this is true of most African Americans, who are decent people, try to see themselves as human beings, treat others as human beings, rather than in terms of black and white. But you run into that obstacle where you're forced back into that box.
Let me ask both of you, since you have had lifelong experience and long lives, if you've noticed a lessening of that forced back stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no question that there have been some real changes. When people talk about the New South, for example,
yes.
that's a reality.
It is a reality.
There's no question about it. But some of us always realized that, in a way, there was more potential for that in the South,
where
people were really folks, and there was a sense of community and mutual caring, even in slavery, than in some of the more callous, impersonal kind of urban North.
Well, there's been remarkable change. I don't hold with people who say things have not changed and never changed. First of all, the legal apparatus of American apartheid has been dismantled. Secondly, people accept that racism is morally wrong. You do still have incidents, as in the case of the black man who was dragged to his death behind a pickup truck. But the interesting thing about that, and that was tragic, but there was a closing of ranks among people of all walks of life, of all colors, to condemn this outrage. So we've gone a very, very long way.
So where are we going now? Is this where we want to be going? Is that the direction that we're headed in? Is it two steps forward and one step back? Does it depend on economics?
I don't think we have the full spectrum of options. I think with the new demographics that are emerging both in our society here and in Europe and everywhere else, you have a coming together of mixtures of peoples. Even in those parts of the world that we don't think of as developed, they're having that experience through all kinds of involuntary dislocations and refugee movements. People are having to be forced to live together. And our only options are learn to live together and be accepting of one another and respectful, or we won't survive.
And that was Martin Luther King's message. We have to learn to live together or perish as fools. I'm in complete agreement with that. Our program at Boston University, African American Studies, is a global program, and it looks at connections between African Americans and other ethnic groups, European Americans, Asian Americans, and populations all over the world, because that's what it's going to be about. We are in a situation today, with our war on terror, where we're sometimes wondering why people in the outside world have the type of ideas that they sometimes have about the United States. And I think one of the things we have to do in order to counter this is to look more closely at the connections that hold us to each other, the influences that connect us, rather than simply at those things that divide us. And we haven't done that as effectively as we should in the case of what used to be called the Third World, Africa and Asia, for example.
Professor Richardson, tell us now about the conference coming up this next weekend.
This conference is called Blacks and Asians, Encounters Through Time and Space, April 12th through 14th, right here at Boston University. What we're going to look at is we're going to shift the paradigm from looking at only black-white relations, America, the rest of the world, to look at relations between people of African descent and people of Asian descent, wherever they have occurred in history all over the world. And they've occurred from antiquity all the way through to the present. And what we hope to accomplish are two things. One, to get outside of the white-black binary. Number two, to simply begin to do what I've just said I thought we needed to do, and that is to look at how populations have influenced each other over the course of history. And I think this helps us to understand, if we look at connections, helps us to understand that we all belong to one race, to the human race. If you look at how a national identity has been constructed since the 18th century in America and anywhere, everywhere else, it's kind of forgetting those things which keep us apart, in a sense, as Ernst Renan said, and looking at those things which bind us together. So this is one of these are the two major goals of the conference.
And historically, Allison Blakely, before we end, How do you see that social construct, or whatever it is, changing?
Well, I think the social construct of race has a very good chance of disappearing once we have the kind of mingling of cultures that's taking place in the world. It won't be a useful construct anymore so far. I mean, just the recent Academy Awards kinds of development, for example, I mean, that's really exciting in terms of the potential for projecting a different kind of mutual acceptance of one another on a grand scale.
Well, that is a lodestone. We'll continue on. Thank you both very much. Professor Ron Richardson, Director of the African American Studies here at Boston University. Professor Allison Blakely, who has a position there, and both men teach in the history department as well. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. We turn now to a recent event at the Mugar Library that calls attention to the Department of Special Collections and its 20th Century Archive. The occasion was the opening of an exhibit of the papers and artifacts of Douglas Fairbanks, Jr., one of the past century's most outstanding motion picture stars. But Fairbanks was much more than that, as those who attended this event discovered. The first speaker is the director of the Department of Special Collections, Dr. Howard B. Gottlieb.
There are 160 cases of papers and memorabilia in the Fairbanks archive, and Mrs. Fairbanks is still gathering material together. I trust that you will enjoy and savor this story of a very fine man's life. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the distinguished scholar and philosopher, the Chancellor of Boston University, Dr. John Silber.
This evening, the friends of library, or to be more precise, the friends of Howard Gottlieb, are met to examine and enjoy one of the most important treasures he has brought to Special Collections. His success in persuading Douglas Fairbanks, Jr. to deposit his archive here rather than elsewhere has to do with the chemistry between the donor and donee. Howard, I suspect, appealed to Douglas Fairbanks, Jr. because he did not approach him as a celebrity movie star, as Fairbanks was best known to millions. Rather, Howard recognized the depth, richness, and complexity of Fairbanks' career as a public-spirited citizen who had excelled in diplomacy, in war, in philanthropy on behalf of worthy causes, in politics as an advisor and as an advocate, as an author, and as a close and beloved friend and correspondent to an extraordinary array of the greatest personalities of his time. He recognized that the Fairbanks papers and memorabilia would constitute a major collection of historical importance. All part of that archive confirms Howard's assessment. Friends of many years remember Mr. Fairbanks met with us on several occasions, including his extended visit in 1989 when he presided as Master of Ceremonies at a banquet celebrating Boston's sesquicentenary. Where one begins in reviewing this exhibition, where I spent 4 hours, is quite arbitrary. I began with photographs of baby Douglas and his mother, Annabeth Sully Fairbanks, and early letters which illustrate his uncertain steps in learning to write. These letters are always affectionate, but his grasp of English grammar, spelling, and punctuation from age 8 to 12 is still precarious. Douglas Fairbanks, Jr. had his first stage success in 1927 before he was 20. His father took note of the occasion by giving him a copy of the drama addresses by Henry Irving, in which Douglas Sr. inscribed a note to Jr. "Let your own discretion be your tutor. Dad, 1927, the occasion being your first appearance on the dramatic stage." Fairbanks' talents were far too varied to be limited to acting on stage and screen. At 20, he was writing profiles of famous Hollywood personalities for Vanity Fair and illustrating them with equally perceptive caricatures. In very few well-selected words, he captured the essence of his subjects. Greta Garbo, he wrote, arrives on a scene of chaos and superficial artificiality, and by the impression of utter boredom, creates a hubbub that has seldom been duplicated in this amazing and colorful profession. Fairbanks' profiles were notable both for their insight and for their benevolence. He never felt the need to put others down. Little wonder, then, that he made so many close and enduring friendships. Although he was a highly successful actor, performing in 75 films with great actors such as Edward G. Robinson, Gertrude Lawrence, Katharine Hepburn, Cary Grant, and Joan Fontaine, this aspect of his life, despite his distinction as an actor, seen in the context of his other extraordinary achievements, is no more than an important interlude. Of central importance, I believe, is Douglas Fairbanks Jr.'s military career. Prior to the outbreak of World War II, Fairbanks wrote to President Roosevelt to request a commission in the Naval Reserve. On February 6, 1941, the President's secretary wrote that he had taken Fairbanks' request directly to General George Marshall. Because of Fairbanks' high visibility and the fear that his appointment would create a precedent that the War Department could not politically resist, his request was denied. The secretary added, "Under these circumstances, the President is sure you will appreciate his reluctance to press the matter." We may ask, at least I did, why Fairbanks should have presumed to write directly to the President, and why the latter would apologize for not pressing his appointment. The explanation is found in other fascinating cases. In 1940, President Roosevelt had appointed Douglas Fairbanks Jr. as his personal envoy to South America, where he would assess the perceptions of the United States acquired through reviewing American motion pictures and the influence of Germany and Japan on public and official opinion. After visiting Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Chile, Peru, and Panama, he was asked to advise on how American interests might be advanced. In June 1941, Fairbanks reported the dominant influence of the German and Japanese military and business interests, and he noted the widely held belief that Americans might not stay the course but accommodate with Hitler. In appreciation of Fairbanks' mission, the President wrote, "I am sure it will do a great deal of good." Fairbanks' diplomatic success was confirmed by decorations and commendations from the leaders of the countries he visited. Fairbanks was well known to Roosevelt because of his extensive speaking and campaigning from 1939 to 1941 in support of the White Committee to defend America by aiding the Allies. He was aware that Fairbanks, on November 4, 1940, gave a speech broadcast nationally on CBS in support of Roosevelt's re-election to an unprecedented third term. Before a national audience, Fairbanks acknowledged the splendid talents of Wendell Willkie, the president's opponent. But then he singled out by name the isolationist leaders in the Senate and the House, who Fairbanks suggested would lead Willkie down a course that would jeopardize the free world. The speech was so well received that it was rebroadcast by the Roosevelt campaign. 1 month later, Fairbanks was an obvious choice as Roosevelt's personal envoy. Roosevelt's aims were occasionally delayed, but only rarely denied. On April 16, 1941, Fairbanks received his commission. 6 months later, he was on a destroyer escorting a convoy of ships to Iceland and Europe in waters infested by German submarine wolf packs. In the spring of 1942, he served on the United States Wasp, delivering Hurricanes and Spitfires to the RAF on Malta, then under heavy attack by the Luftwaffe. The admiral described the beleaguered RAF pilots as those poor kids. After assigning Fairbanks responsibility for gunnery and communications, for the most part, for you,
is that I want you to write up the whole operation in every detail in the form of a combined log report and a history for the Navy's official records and mine, too. He continued, if you come back safe, and I hope you will, and do well, I may send you on another job like this. I know you like lots of action. Fairbanks' wartime service was not sheltered like that of many celebrities, but it was service in harm's way. The significance and quality of Fairbanks' military service can be judged by the many decorations he earned, including the Silver Star. Fairbanks' affection for the English was deepened by his wartime service with the British Armed Forces. In 1947, concern for the plight of the English people suffering under post-war austerity, Fairbanks led an appeal for care. It was a huge success, and 100,000 care packages were delivered at Princess Elizabeth's discretion to the most needy families. Having established himself politically in the Roosevelt administration, Fairbanks maintained a close association with most of his successors. I call to your attention one of on September 20th, 1951, Dwight Eisenhower rejected Fairbanks' suggestion that he consider a run for the presidency. A letter from Lady Bird Johnson confirmed once more what Howard spoke of, Fairbanks' innate modesty. She wrote, I love your description of yourself as Agent 003.5. One should not overlook the album of photographs and commentary of Fairbanks' career and that of his father, which he edited and distributed widely to hundreds of friends. These glimpses into a remarkable life, so well lived, are an inspiration and an important reminder that among our celebrities, on rare occasions, there is an individual of great substance, of enormous ability, versatility, and hard work, who holds himself to the highest standards in all his endeavors, and who subordinates his personal goals to service to his country and to those in need. Considering his gifts of mind and spirit and his achievement in so many fields, Douglas Fairbanks Jr. is singular in his modesty and friendliness. Those of us privileged to have known Mr. Fairbanks can never think of him as other than one of us, a friend of the library and our friend, whose memory is kept fresh through his fascinating archive.
Thank you, Dr. Silva. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Douglas Fairbanks, Jr.
Well, I'm beginning to think that Dr. Silva wrote my speech. So if I repeat anything, I'll be asking you questions after to see if you remember. Douglas Fairbanks, Jr., who is the man behind the legacy? And what was his secret to life? To begin with, in looking through Who's Who, one finds that the space devoted to Douglas Fairbanks, Jr. is comparable to that of five noteworthy people on the other side of the page. One wonders whether his life was scripted and plotted by Cecil B. DeMille. Douglas's life was as full and diversified as one could possibly imagine, leaving very little out. Thumbing through his staggeringly immense collection of diaries, personal letters, documents, photographs, published articles, albums, one finds a man of tremendous range. Known as an actor of film, stage, and television, he was equally at home in castles or modern drawing rooms, on or off the screen, equally at ease with a sword or an epigram, or as an adventurer with dash and chivalry. Douglas also produced some of his own films and his own television series called Douglas Fairbanks Jr. Presents. But less known were his many services in international affairs. He served a full commander in the Navy, ensuring him the Distinguished Service Cross, the Silver Star Medal, the Combat Legion of Merit with V for Valor attachment, not to mention decorations from a dozen allied countries, including the first KBE given to an American actor, conferred by King George VI. And withal, he was as unaffected and nonchalant and debonair at 90 as he was when he first won the hearts of audiences worldwide 75 years earlier. I can still remember when in 1991 we were invited to the White House for the Queen of England's state visit, decorations to be worn. Douglas's chest was covered with medals. As we walked up the red carpet to the White House, one of the paparazzi yelled out to Douglas, "Hey, Mr. Fairbanks, where did you get all those medals?" He winked and smiled and called back, "I rented them for the evening." He was charmingly modest as well. After the war, Douglas maintained his contacts in government circles both here and abroad. He directed much of his time and energy to public service causes such as CARE, the American Association for the United Nations with Eleanor Roosevelt, which became the United Nations, pioneering and fostering Anglo-American relations, serving as chairman of American Relief for Korea, as board member of associations such as United World Colleges, the Pilgrim Society, Variety Clubs International, and so many more too numerous to mention. A true patriot, he was a man who served his profession and country always with tact and diplomacy. If one were to ask Douglas, though, what his secret to life was, he would answer very simply, it was the joy of living. Douglas loved life unconditionally, never being bored a day in his life. He wanted to do and to experience everything firsthand. His mother, Annabeth Sully, said of her son, "Douglas sees everything and is interested in everything he sees." Friends of Douglas's were his friends for life, cherishing in particular his stepmother, Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin, Laurence Olivier, David Niven, Leslie Howard, Noel Coward, the Mountbatten family, and Jeannie Chester. Jeannie was a childhood friend from Watch Hill, Rhode Island, who was stricken with polio at a very young age. That never stopped Douglas from taking her to the theater. He carried her on his back. Above all, he was a gentleman in the most noble sense. I once asked Douglas, "Why are you so modest?" He thought for a moment and replied, "I have a lot to be modest about." Thank you.
Mrs. Douglas Fairbanks, Jr., speaking at the opening of the Mugar Library exhibit honoring her husband, drawn from the Department of Special Collections. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild, with help from Michael Garth, Tina Toby, and Alex Ashlock. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for being with us.